Iowa's online.
And is Fairbanks LIO online?
Fairbanks LIO is online.
Very good, gentlemen. I hope you understand what's occurring right now. You can talk to Representative Ryan later. Representative Ryan, would you like to give us this kind of a once over lightly on your bill, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. House Bill 266 hopes to take care of an opportunity that was offered the first of this year. The IRS on limited liability companies and limited partnerships had a rather long, complicated set of regulations to try to make sure these people were not using them to escape corporation taxes, and they had a number of tests. If you hit any two of the tests, you're considered, for practical purposes, a taxation person, a corporation. And this got very difficult to administer, and there were a few attorneys who could understand it, and so a model law was written, as well, a uniform law, and this is what's been used. It's been very cumbersome and expensive. And I think 2 years ago, we introduced this limited liability company into Alaska. Well, the first of this year, the IRS repealed those regulations. Now all you have to do is to make application to check the box as an entry classification, and you have done. And we feel that, myself sponsoring this legislation, I feel that we are in an opportunity to remain at the cutting edge of businesses, to attract limited liability companies and limited partnerships to be formed in Alaska. With the internet today, it makes things a lot easier. And we're cleaning up these statutes and making them easier and more simple. Will allow people to use this vehicle in Alaska, and which eventually will bring more business to Alaska. So that's the purpose behind this. There are some folks online who are much more aware of the technical aspects than I, and I'm sure they would be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. President Ryan. First, we'd like to go to Anchorage and Jerry Weaver, please.
Mr. Chairman, this is Jerry Weaver with the Alaska Bankers Association, but because the committee's not going to vote on the bill, I actually have no comments on it at this time.
So, Mr. Weaver, does the association have an opinion on the bill? Or?
Not yet, Mr. Chairman. We've only had about an hour or two to look at the bill. We've just made arrangements with some of the sponsors to work closely with them so we can gain an understanding very, very quickly.
Well, we'll try to get an expedited hearing to the bill, and we will be taking this up again on Friday, hopefully with more limited testimony, but we will be considering it on Friday or to call it a chair.
He is talking about this.
And that's one of the best choices for the bankers, Mr. Chairman.
No. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Weaver. Mr. Mike Stone, are you available?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
Could you identify yourself and your affiliation and number, phone number for the record, please?
My name is Mike Stone. I'm here representing myself. I'm a certified public accountant. My phone number is 265-1211. And while I have not been involved in drafting this legislation per se, I certainly would speak to the benefits of passing legislation that would simplify state law, given the fact that the Internal Revenue Service did greatly simplify their approach on classification of entities. And as Mr. Ryan has said, many of the tests that were required to be in state law before, so that we could be assured that these entities would be treated as partnerships, really for income tax purposes only, really are no longer needed because of the IRS's change of position. It literally is the situation where you can check the box and determine whether you want to be taxed as a partnership or as a corporation. So just as a general statement for myself, any simplification of the law that would make it easier to work with and fall in line with the check-the-box regulations issued by the IRS would be beneficial.
Mr. Stone.
Yes, sir.
There is basically the four tests that were considered the differentials between limited partnerships, LLCs, and corporations. As I recall from my my history in business, there was what was called a safe harbor rule. Is that Is that germane to this topic?
Well, the safe, there really were not a safe harbor per se. It was more that we had to be sure that we didn't have continuity of life, or we didn't have to tell you the truth, I can't remember what the four items are off the top of my head, but it was a matter of having to draft very carefully such that you would fail at least two of these tests, so you wouldn't be thrown in to be taxed like a corporation, even though you were actually organized as a partnership entity. So it was a matter of careful drafting to avoid the tax treatment of being taxed like a corporation.
Wasn't that where the general partner and a limited partnership could be a corporation, and then that created those tests then? Is that where the areas where there was some concern when you were drafting and organizing a limited partnership historically that came into play?
Yes, sir. And as a matter of fact, now that you mentioned that, there were some rulings that were put out by the IRS that kind of gave safe harbors, saying that, well, look, if you're going to have a limited partnership and the general partner is a corporation, then we will respect that corporation as the general partner so long as it has X dollars of equity. In other words, they were very concerned that, in essence, you would set up a limited partnership where in effect, no one had liability because the corporation was judgment-proof because it had no assets. So that was where there were some rulings out there that dealt with kind of the safe harbor of what you needed for equity in that corporate general partner. And as I say, basically, with the IRS backing off from this whole area, those types of concerns really aren't present anymore, so we don't have to deal with them.
And Mr. Stone, have you had a chance to read the bill itself?
I have read the bill. I cannot tell you that I have studied the bill, but I have read the bill.
I mean, and there's a couple of attorneys online that we'll be hearing from. I guess some of my concerns are that I'm not sure why some of these changes are being made in our existing statutes when, in fact, we're trying to speak to IRS regulations. For example, one that troubles me is that both in the LLC portion of the bill and in the limited partnership portion of the bill, it requires a unanimous or 100% vote of the members to amend or to change their operating agreements or something, unless there's another method stipulated in their operating agreement. For example, in the LLCs, they went from a two-thirds to all members. How would that affect a tax situation?
Well, I'll give you an answer, but I also will defer to Mr. Hompish as one who has been very much involved in drafting this. I asked the same question, and the one thing that I came up with was that since we are going to a situation where we can have a one-member LLC, then in trying to make these things make the law kind of hold together, you obviously, if you have a one-member LLC, you can no longer have a two-thirds vote. So that's my thought, is that when you go to a one-member LLC situation, then everyone can, you would need it all in that situation to vote for it. But the other thing, which Mr. Hompish, I'm sure, will point out, is that that particular one is a default provision, such that if your operating agreement can state something other than all, and that will be respected as the law indicates.
And I think the same thing would apply with the withdrawal. It seems to me that historically there's a lot of, unfortunately, I have too much personal knowledge of the history of real estate limited partnerships in the United States and the state of Alaska. And it seems to me that if there's a prohibition on withdrawal, that there could be some difficulties that may come about here, particularly when, isn't it true, for example, if you had a limited partnership which, because of the nature of its asset base, was accruing continual losses, and also at the same time with an accelerated depreciation schedule, the capital account was going further into negative, and the prospects for a turnaround of that particular partnership were, if there's an ability to elect to withdraw by a limited partner at a point in time, it may be prudent for the limited partner to be able to withdraw unilaterally and cut his further losses if he made a judgment. And then I'm concerned we're in this bill that there's restrictions on the ability to withdraw under this. I mean, are we going to be doing something here that would affect that? Or it would, in fact, that be a circumstance sometimes, the fact pattern might have described hypothetically?
Hypothetically, the fact pattern that you described, certainly we have seen that happen in the past. And actually, the income tax law has changed somewhat in terms of looking at the at-risk provisions for real estate that kind of lends itself to where you would no longer get to take those losses. But your point is still a valid one as far as many limited partners wanted the ability to be rid of these limited partnerships. And I cannot speak to what the provisions in here, how that would affect that, and I would ask that we ask Mr. Hompish on that. But your hypothetical example certainly has occurred. There's no doubt about it.
Right, okay. Because it is on page 10 in section 17, specifically on that point. And I brought it up to you because of it would be some advice a CPA may give to a client if he did an analysis of the investment situation and may have recommended to a client that would be a prudent course of action. Have you ever been in that situation where you've recommended that?
It's been more the situation where I have run the numbers for my clients and indicated that if they were tired of dealing with it, the pain would not be too great to get out of it.
And they usually then, would their basis be at the time they withdrew, and that would be provided for either under the state statutes that applied to that particular organization and or the written agreement?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand your question.
I'm not sure I did either. Let me restate it. So at the point of withdrawal, it would be depend on the laws of the state of the limited partnership at the time, where that was a domicile, say it was a Delaware limited partnership, or it could be stipulated in the written agreement, I take.
Right, and what I have seen in that, specifically what we did was my client, the limited partner, requested of the general partner that he basically relinquish his limited partnership interest. And then the general partner acknowledged and agreed to that, and we did it. I mean, so the kind of what happened was that the limited partner says, hey, I'm tired of this. I don't want to do it anymore. Please allow me to withdraw from this partnership, Mr. General Partner. And the general partner said, okay, you may withdraw. I mean, that's kind of how it has taken place in the past. And I don't know, perhaps in this situation, this would contemplate that the partnership agreement would allow for the same type of process more than likely.
Thank you. Is there any other questions of Mr. Stone? Hearing none, thank you very much, Mr. Stone. Next, we'd like to go to Rich Hompish in Fairbanks, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rich Hompish. I'm an attorney in Fairbanks. And I'd like to address Chairman Roper, your two points regarding Section 3 and Section 17 of the bill. And the first thing I'd like to bring to the committee's attention is the applicability provision, that's section 24. This bill and these changes in the law would not apply to any existing partnership or limited liability company unless the entity filed an amendment with the Division of Department of Commerce and Economic Development stating that this law will apply. So, if, Chairman, you're asking about any existing partnership or limited liability company, then the answer is nothing has changed. Old law would still apply to those existing entities. Second, section 3 on page 2 states that unless another level of consent is required in an operating agreement of the company, then the written consent of all members is required. This bill does not prohibit members of a limited liability company from deciding that, you know, 51% or two-thirds or any other number of members are required to amend the articles of organization, for example. What the law says, or the bill provides, is that unless the operating agreement otherwise provides, everyone must agree. And I think that's only fair to the, you know, if you have a 10% interest in an entity, I think it's only fair that the terms of your agreement do not vary just because two-thirds of the members are voting in favor of it. Section 17.
Excuse me, Mr. Huppish, if I could interject there, but is that a matter of policy judgment, or does that reflect to the new IRS code?
Well, it does have a very significant impact in the Internal Revenue Code. And to explain this, it's going to take me a minute.
Well, plenty of time here. We're not in a committee hearing.
Okay. Well, thank you. The question under Chapter 14 of the Internal Revenue Code is, what is the value of an interest in a limited liability company or a limited partnership? Now, what the IRS has done is said, for purposes of valuation, we're going to disregard the terms of the agreement, and we're going to look to Bear State law. So, if Bear State law says that upon two-thirds the vote of the members, you can change anything in your agreement, then what happens is the IRS will, well, for instance, on liquidation, the IRS would say if the decedent owned 80% and 80% interest in the entity, and let's say if the decedent owned 80% of the entity, the IRS would say that the decedent could then completely liquidate the company and get the money for the estate. If an estate can be paid 100% for its interest in a limited liability company when a person dies, that person's interest in the limited liability company will be worth far more than if that entity continued and perhaps would only be liquidated in 20 years in the future.
So, Mr. Huppish, yeah, I've been active in the business world for 30 years, but because of the advent of the LLCs, I have not had an opportunity to be personally involved with a formation or working with an LLC. For the record and for the committee's education, could you just take a moment to draw some distinctions between what an LLC is and limited partnership so we have a better understanding of that, just as a background?
Certainly, Chairman Roper. The difference, well, they're very similar. The big difference is in a limited liability company, although the company is taxed in most instances like a partnership, all of the members have limited liability. By contrast, a limited partnership, although again, in most instances, it's taxed as a partnership, at least one member has unlimited liability, and that member is the general partner. I think that's the best way to sum up the differences.
Well, then, but historically, then, usually to have, clearly in a limited partnership, you'd have to have one more than one member, but in an LLC, this new, the bill before us goes into, you could establish an LLC with just one member. Is that unusual, or could you speak to that?
Yes, Chairman Roper. Treasury Regulation Section 301.77013(a)(parens) changed the rules and provides that a sole proprietor could become a limited liability company and still be taxed as a sole proprietor. So that was a change, that was a direct result of a change in the Internal Revenue Code or the IRS's position.
When did that happen, Rich?
Please don't quote me, but I believe it's part of the check the box regulations.
So this is a new change in the IRS, really?
I believe so. And it has a significant impact on Alaskan businesses for this reason. Under existing law, if a person comes to me and says, I would like to incorporate and have limited liability, but I would be the sole shareholder of the entity.
Normally, you'd recommend a sub-S if that was appropriate, historically,
yes.
Right?
The disadvantage with a sub-S corporation is that if a sub-S corporation distributes assets that have appreciated in value, upon the distribution, there is a taxable event, and the sole shareholder would have to pay a capital gains tax on any appreciation of the asset. However, if we allow one-member LLCs in Alaska, the LLC would be taxed as a sole proprietorship, and most of the time, the distribution of an asset from a one-member LLC would not be a taxable event.
Why, is it a draw then? Like would it be like a draw in the terms of tax, its taxability? I mean, I don't understand that distinction. Is that?
Who do you pay?
It's present in the Internal Revenue Code, and I don't know that there's a valid policy.
What's an example of that, Simon?
Okay, well, let's say, for instance, I want to form a corporation, and I take a piece of real estate, and I contribute that to the corporation. And let's say I make an S election. And let's say I'm thinking of building a building on this real estate. It's bare land right now, but I'm wanting to build a building on it to operate my business out of it. And time goes on, and the real estate goes up in value. Let's say it goes from $10,000 to $20,000. So there's $20,000 of appreciation. Well, let's say as time goes on, I realize that I really don't need that real estate after all in the company. And the company, it's best to distribute that real estate back out of the corporation. Under the rules for S corporations, the company would recognize a $10,000 long-term capital gain when it distributes the real estate to me, and there'd be a tax of $2,800 on a long-term capital gain, even though no money changed hands. Whereas if we did the same scenario with a limited liability company, I wouldn't have to pay a tax as the sole proprietor.
When in fact there was no real alienation of the property, but it would be a taxable event because there was a change of title, but from one pocket to the other, but then you create a taxable event, right?
Yeah. Under
a sub S.
Under a sub S and a C corp is
right.
Worse.
Yeah, right.
Another entity, a legal entity.
Right.
So it would save income taxes for the small Alaska family-owned business. Sole proprietorship.
Well, I'm really excited about this, being a sole proprietor of a business right now. So you're suggesting with this bill, a sole proprietorship could be turned into an LLC and gain the benefits in terms of liability. And then under an LLC is the corporate veil that you get in a C-type corp in terms of the case law and what's been built up. How does that compare LLC to a C-corp, for example?
Well, Mr. Chairman, there are a few cases involving LLCs at this juncture, that, and I think most attorneys would agree that the case law involving corporations is analogous to limited liability companies, so probably the courts would adopt that case law when dealing with the same issues in an LLC. But at this point, I think it's a still an open question.
And but the primary benefit, though, is as for example, you go to a lender, and arrange for financing, and under an LLC, if in fact the lender is willing to grant you that, that they would have only a recourse to the asset rather than to an individual, unless there was a requirement by the lender of a personal guarantee. Is that correct?
That's correct, and in my experience, the lender always asks for personal guarantee.
In Alaska, they probably do. Maybe that's why Mr. Coiner is here and Mr. Weaver is here. But that, so, look, the, so what other benefits would accrue under an LLC to a sole proprietor then, besides the debt and the protection of their own personal portfolio?
Well, I think that's in essence all the benefits that I can think of offhand. I defer to Mr. Thwaites or anyone else in Anchorage on that. That's all I can think of right now.
But then if there was a third-party cause of action for, like there was an action on tort, those are the types of things that would protect the assets of the... Say it's called a single LLC. Then is
that not necessarily, Mr. Chairman? If the sole member of the LLC was negligent, that person is always going to be liable for their own negligence. This bill does not change that. However, if an employee of the limited liability company was negligent, but the member was not, then the member's personal assets outside of the LLC would not be at risk.
So just the asset base of the LLC, like anything else, would be the assets were exposed to risk for any kind of cause of action against it. Right. Okay.
For a claim against an employee of the LLC.
Right. So that's exciting about the first part. So that's on page one. And could you talk about this, the idea of the well, Mr. Stone, did you cover the two-thirds and the unanimous there sufficiently for the folks here in the committee? Because I noticed in Section 21 also, you're adding a whole new provision. What's the current law in terms of a change of the partnership agreement for a limited partnership? Because you've added a new section here that has to be by unanimous consent on page 12, Section 21. What's the current law in the last one there? Or is it silent?
Mr. Chairman, are you speaking to me? Or?
Yes, I am.
I believe this is the law, but the IRS apparently at times has argued otherwise. So this will clarify what we think the law is, which is all members of partnership agreement have to agree if the agreement gets changed.
Yeah. Okay, let's go on. I'm going to kind of go through the bill real quickly here, Mr. Hoppish. And Mr. Thwaites, are you there?
Yes, Chair Roper, I am.
Yeah. Dick, if you want to, this is a little more informal here. If you want to chime in, just identifying yourself with the Secretary at any point, feel free to do so.
Thank you. So far, I think that I'll defer to Mr. Hoppish.
Okay, very good. And the questions will be directed to Mr. Hoppish, unless otherwise. On page 3, section 6, You've added a foreign limited liability company. Is that defined anywhere else in the existing statute, or?
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman. It's in the definition section.
In the bill, or?
No, it's
Oh, okay, it's in the statute.
Law. This was this change was suggested to me by an Anchorage attorney, Bob Manley, who worked on, I understand, worked on the original Limited Liability Act, and he mentioned to me that some of the attorneys felt that this should have been clarified in the original act, because the definition of a limited liability company does not include a foreign limited liability company, but it was understood that this provision would apply to both. So this Section 6 is not a change that's come about because of the change in the IRS regulations.
This is what we were talking about earlier about one of the values of a limited liability company, about any liability to a third party that it might, where it says it arises out of a contract, tort, or other form. All right, Representative Joe.
Mr. Oppish, we're still talking about using the term foreign as a foreign country and or foreign state, is that correct? As long as it's not incorporated as Alaska? Yeah, I just want to...
The reference that Mr. Manley mentioned to me, I found it in the definition section of 10.50.990, and it's sub 9 in existing law, says a limited liability company or domestic limited liability company means an organization organized under this chapter. That is...
Right.
And I think it was intended that as to foreign limited liability companies, there would also be limited liability as to third parties. So this is a change that just clarifies that.
Okay, thank you.
And, okay, down on page 3, section 7, why was this language... remove starting in line 23 through 29. I'm not sure I fully understand the intention. It seems to me a tighter language, which you've replaced with, or the drafters replaced with looser language. Could you give me some reason for that?
Well, yes, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding that when the limited liability company was adopted, there was included a special election under AS 1050085A, and as I understand it, the purpose of this election was to make sure that an Alaska limited liability company would not have one of the four corporate characteristics, which is continuity of life. Now, that corporate characteristic is really irrelevant, so it was deleted. And it was suggested to me by attorney Dave Chaptel, who was involved with the original act, that it would be appropriate to make this deletion. Every reference to the old election has been deleted, and this is one of them.
Because the courts are going to be looking at the statute here in case there is a dissolution, presumably, I guess. Would that be correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, yeah.
And you left that in there, this court's entered decree under the 405 provision.
Yes.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Ryan.
Under the old continuity of life, people had artificially set up a corporation that somehow would terminate so that there couldn't be continuity of your life and they would qualify as a double taxation basis. Now, since we no longer need to meet that requirement, this is just stripping that excess verbiage out of the document and not having people have to go through and set up these artificial barriers to meet a tax requirement.
Well, what would occur then if there was a need to, there was a failure of the partners within a limited liability company and they wanted to dissolve it and reorganize it? I mean, what occurs then?
Well, Mr. Chairman, so long as all of them agree to dissolve, the entity would be dissolved.
Or the court orders.
before the court could order it then.
Yeah, but this speaks back to your unanimous thing, unanimous consent situation.
Well,
what if one guy wants to get out, though?
It's only fair.
Mr. Chairman, if your agreement said that if one member wanted to get out, that one member could get out, then what you see in Section 7 wouldn't be a problem, because Section 7 under 1050-401 says that you can have a dissolution at any time or on the happening of events specified in the operating agreement. So if the operating agreement said if one person wants to dissolve the entity, then the entity dissolves, then that's what would happen. Elsewhere, we talk about withdrawal. If the agreement provides that one member may withdraw at any time, then, of course, that provision in the agreement controls over the statute.
Well, as a matter of customary practice, would a interest in an LLC be marketable similar to a limited partnership interest? Is that?
Depends how we're doing, I imagine.
Right, it depends on the nature of the makeup of the, number one, the agreement. For example, I imagine you have like first rights of refusal and or first rights of offers type of things requiring sale of a small LLC internally, or there'd be some type of a potential secondary market where you can alienate your percentage share of an LLC just like a limited partnership. Is that correct, Mr. Hunter?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in my experience, there isn't much of a market.
Well, I know, but one does exist. I've been involved in that in my own conduct of affairs. There's usually a substantial discounts, and typically they're a real estate asset base.
Yes, I agree. Well, Chairman, this is Dick Waits in Anchorage. And I think also you might have some securities differences as well, whereas your limited partnership would have some additional requirements there because you're relying on the general partner and other management. Whereas in the LLC, you have more universal management like a partnership and you aren't subject to the same strict rules. So that's going to affect your valuation as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. How long have LLCs been in existence in American law?
1976.
But they've in Alaska, how long is it?
1995. Alaska was actually approached first in 1974, but they chose not to adopt it, and Wyoming adopted it in 1976 as the first state.
Okay, let's move on to Section 8, where the standard for dissolution by court is not reasonably practicable to continue operation. It has been changed to impossible. Seems like we're raising to a relatively high, or about the highest standard you can get here. I'm not sure I understand why that was done.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is Rich Hoffish, and I can address that. I believe I surveyed a number of different states, Delaware, Georgia, and a few others, and I'm not sure which state has this language, but the issue here is one evaluation by the IRS. If a court can liquidate an LLC and an estate can be paid in cash for its interest, then the more easily the court can do this, the higher the value of the interest in the LLC, and the more estate taxes that would have to be paid. So, again, the members of an LLC in an operating agreement can agree that, gee, we're going to allow the court to dissolve us whenever the court wants to. And that certainly would be enforceable. However, if the members of an LLC do not want the court to dissolve it, very easily, and most family businesses feel that way, in order for that provision to be enforceable, it has to appear in state law. And I believe that's why one of the other states that I surveyed had this provision.
So this would make it more difficult for the dissolution to take effect then by court order.
Yes, and it would also cause, for tax estate tax purposes, it would cause interest in the LLC to be worth less for federal estate tax purposes. And that's something that most...
Why, because you're not breaking up the asset base?
Exactly, Mr. Chairman, exactly. It's harder to break it up.
I guess it depends on what your interest is in, I guess, okay.
Well, if you are a family business, if most families are very concerned when they find out that when the matriarch dies, that the business could be broken up under bare state law, and basically that would mean the end of the business, and that the IRS is going to tax the business on that basis. Most of my clients are very astounded by that. Because most people, if they have a business and it's for their family, they would like the business to continue.
Mm-hmm.
And not have the IRS tax it at its highest maximum value, so that basically the business has to be sold in order to pay the tax.
So the IRS would take their leads, in this instance, perhaps from the state law and the ability of the courts to do that, then. Is that what you're testifying?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Under Chapter 14, that's exactly what the IRS, the Internal Revenue Code, states.
Okay.
They're going to look at bare state law. That obviously, you know, private individuals can otherwise agree. But,
I don't know that.
We've got time. I've got to take it away yet.
Oh, you have a committee?
Yeah, well, I got this thing with foreign trade. Go feet.
Well, it's your bill, man.
Well, I'm pretty satisfied with it. You've got any more, I'll stick around.
I got questions. Well, let's see. Mr. Hoppish, I don't want to tie up too many. Representative Ryan has other activities. I do have several other questions. Maybe it'd be. Perhaps if I could get a hold of you and talk to you directly, then when we reconvene, we could identify a few things that may be appropriate to put on a record in a shorter period of time. That might be the most appropriate way to handle this.
Well, that'd be fine, Mr. Chairman. When would you like me to call you?
Well, I guess I'm going to have to call you because okay. My schedule, I'm not sure what it's like. Are you going to be at your office tomorrow?
Yes, I will.
And just could you give me your number, please?
It's 452-1700.
Okay. I'm not sure. I may try to give you a call. I'm not sure what my schedule is like. I'll try to give you a call in the morning hours or... If to set up a time to make sure that you're going to be available.
I'll look forward to it.
If not, we'll try to connect there because I would be my intention if I can bring this bill up tomorrow. I'm going to by a special call of the chair.
Either.
If not, we will be hearing this on Friday at a regularly scheduled meeting. I think this is a major, real positive bill, but I want to make sure we have an adequate public record because it's the only committee referral. The administration is represented here at their work session. I want to make sure the administration is aware of what this bill does. So hopefully we can get their support behind this bill, and it will provide the greater possibility of success in this session. And with that, I bid everybody adieu down the line, and thank you very much for your patience this afternoon and the time you spent on this legislation. And with that, this work session is... Be named. Thank you very much.